There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast is being brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit CodeRedRoofers.com.
News Talk 850 WFTL presents Joyce Kaufman, No Restraint. Here's Joyce Kaufman.
Hi, this is Joyce Kaufman, and on today's No Restraint podcast, we got to go back to Israel. And the reason is because there's so much misinformation or bad information out there that every now and again, I just have to hit you with some cold, hard facts. Thanks to all of the publications that I get to read from out of Israel and even some here in the States, I refute what President Joe Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, have had to say about Israel. And even more importantly, it's time to call out anybody who's a member of the Jewish population that still supports Democrats who literally hate you like poison, hate Israel, want to see it wiped off the face of the earth from the river to the sea. That's how Democrats feel about Israel. Like AOC. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she's never been a friend of Israel, but her recent blood libel commentary that Israel is committing an unfolding genocide in Gaza puts her squarely in the Jew-hating camp. AOC needs a refresher course on the Bible, because God says, "I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you, I will curse." Evangelical Christians, we understand this better than any other group. I don't think AOC has ever heard it before. It's a shame that AOC was educated by a self-hating Jew by the name of Senator Bernie Sanders. Look, I wish I'd had a chance to educate her before she entered politics, because had I known she was even interested in politics, I would have done my utmost to influence her views on the Jews and Israel. But AOC has chosen the dark side, and she will one day discover that the Almighty runs the world. There's not a single person or nation that has cursed the Jews and Israel that has not felt God's wrath. The anti-Semites always come out of the woodwork when they see an opportunity to disparage and degrade the Jewish people. And their fate is always eternal suffering and failure. Israel, right now, is fighting for its survival. It's also fighting for the survival of democracy and freedom and morality. Israel's not causing a humanitarian crisis. Hamas is. Hamas is killing innocent women and children. They use their own people as human shields, and that's a well-established fact. They steal humanitarian aid and constantly disrupt the supply chains. The media doesn't want to cover this, but it is the main reason for the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Israel, on the other hand, continues to do its best to protect non-combatants. And believe me, individual soldiers have told me this from firsthand experience. But those stories never get covered by the media because they don't fit the anti-Israel narrative. Israel did not start this war. Israel hates war. Hamas started this war, and it's been milking its media collaborators just so they can distort reality any way they can. And as expected, the media has swallowed Hamas's lies hook, line, and sinker. Worse yet, so has the political class. AOC is not just a liar, she's also a hypocrite. As a feminist, she ought to be concentrating on the serial rapes and torture of women perpetrated by Hamas. As an American, she should be doing everything possible to free the hostages, who, by the way, include American citizens. She should acknowledge Israel's role in maintaining stability in a very volatile neighborhood, from which America, by the way, benefits. In the end, it doesn't matter. Her lies about Israel will doom her and her followers. It may not happen overnight, but it will happen. And I suggest she, and maybe you, start reading the Bible. You might learn a thing or two. Even after October 7th, the world continues to willfully ignore Palestinian leaders' genocidal threats. Western leaders continue to push for a two-state solution, even though it's an existential danger to Israel. By the way, I think there are two states, Israel and Jordan. Oh, that's right. Jordan doesn't want those people in its country. The West's bloody 20th century seems to have scarred and terrified it to such an extent that it avoids confronting danger, even if it leads to another Holocaust and immiserates the Palestinians. Though 80% of the American population still supports Israel in its war against Hamas, many so-called good people support, justify, or deny that October 7th even happened. They're often highly educated elites and these young people who are brainwashed by a misguided Western academia. Both mainstream and social media compound the problem through all the misinformation and the double standards. Astoundingly, at a time when microaggressions against any other group result in immediate cancellation, anti-Semitism is protected in the name of free speech. Microaggressions result mainly in hurt feelings, while the demonization of Jews causes hate crimes and threats of further massacres. While they are a small minority, there are even Jews and Israelis who believe Palestinian violence is Israel's fault. They usually claim that the Palestinians are violent because they have nothing to lose. They further assert that this is a territorial problem that can be resolved by Israeli concessions. Such people believe they will be spared by the haters, oblivious to the fact that they are and will always be targets. They genuinely believe that they are good people because they support the apparent underdog at their own cost and care about their enemy more than they care about themselves or their fellow Jews. They think they are demonstrating just how compassionate they are. You must wonder, over 2,000 years in the diaspora, did the Jews not develop a secondary identity as a people that abhors and never uses violence, no matter the cost to itself? Did they come to believe that that's the essence of Judaism? If so, they are wrong. The Torah teaches to love the stranger, but it never commands us to love our mortal enemies and let them massacre us. Could this dysfunctional diaspora mentality influence the world's attitude towards Jews in general? It has been said that people often love dead Jews but hate living Jews. If so, do we unwittingly encourage such an attitude? Let's hope not, because it only results in irrational expectations and demands. It makes the world believe it has the right to dictate the morality and the behavior of the nation of Israel. It is true that as moral people who suffered immense horror and cruelty, they are required to be empathetic towards any people suffering. But in the case of this war, moral clarity requires that you put the blame on Hamas, on the Gazans who support Hamas, and on the international media and organizations who refuse to denounce Hamas's atrocities. They are responsible for Gaza's suffering, not Israel. Failing to accept this responsibility will only perpetuate suffering. And sadly, Gazans, brainwashed by Hamas, will not accept living in peace with Israel. And the proof is that they're not calling on Hamas to return the hostages and surrender. They did not condemn Hamas's savagery, but they celebrated it and even participated in it. It's time for the world to wake up and realize that only vanquishing Hamas will give peace a chance. It will save Israeli and Gazan lives, not to mention those of diaspora Jews. It will save the West. It will save the Arab countries silently praying for their radical Islamic arch enemy to disappear. It's time to recognize that Jews do not need the world to protect their moral purity. Jews know how to do that themselves. Let Israel fulfill its obligation of self-defense and serve as the world's front line against evil, rather than canaries in the coal mine. Israel will accomplish its task quicker and with less suffering if its hands are not shackled and the media does not misrepresent the facts. Israelis must be free to be ethical warriors. Everyone will be better off. There's a book that made a deep impression on many people, including me. It's called Esh Kadesh, and it was written in secret in the Warsaw ghetto by a rabbi, Rabbi Kalonymus Kalman Zabiro. And he was a Rebbe, and he buried this accounting in milk churns underneath the Warsaw ghetto. He was murdered by the Nazis in November of 1943, but his writings were discovered after the war, and they were published by his surviving students. Among his teachings, I have always been guided by the principle that in the depth of despair and tragedy, one should seek out the person who needs help. Even in the darkest hour, find ways to do acts of loving kindness. Turn the paralysis of grief and trauma into the positive of helping someone else, even if it might be your final act. That was the lesson of the rabbi's own life. At a time when it seemed as though the Jewish people had no future and were doomed to be wiped out, he continued to live and work as though tomorrow would always come. The very act of preserving testimonies and burying them was an act of hope that there would be survivors to find these hidden writings and that the remnant of the Jewish people would be restored. Which, of course, brings us to this holiday, Purim. It's hard to think about celebrating any festival in Israel's current situation, let alone the raucous, joyous, silly season of Purim with its dressing up and feasting. Months of war, hostages in Gaza, vast numbers of bereaved families, thousands of war wounded, an entire nation still deep in trauma and grief since October 7th. Really, who has the stomach now for parties and clowns and making merry?
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Tolls, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And yet, this is precisely Purim. Purim isn't carnival. It isn't a celebration for celebration's sake, but a Jewish holiday commemorating the deliverance from annihilation. Haman, the Amalekite, had convinced the drinking and carousing Persian emperor to let him kill all the Jewish people in Shushan, effectively the entire Jewish nation at the time. Purim, despite being clothed in fun and silliness, is a story of Jews successfully defending themselves against enemies set on their genocide. The ensuing celebration is not an easy one. Mordechai and Esther instruct the Jewish people how to observe this festival of Thanksgiving. They said, in the month that turned from grief to joy, from mourning to a holiday, to commemorate them as days of feasting and joy, giving food gifts to friends and gifts to the poor. It is one thing to breathe a sigh of relief at being saved from destruction and another to actively celebrate that deliverance. A traumatized, exhausted people who have just fought against murderous mobs can't necessarily see the broad historical perspective. Mordechai and Esther had the vision to know how to mark the occasion. The enormity of these events needed to be remembered throughout the generations to serve as a source of eternal faith that whatever dire straits the Jewish people might face, the tables could be turned. In my mind, they were also looking to heal the deeply scarred and traumatized Jewish people. The merriment, the emphasis on the topsy-turvy turn of events, could help the Jews release some of their pain and grief by focusing on celebrating life, l'chaim, on finding a way to be joyful and thankful despite the horrors. Their instructions to hold joyful feasts recall the lavish parties of the decadent Persian emperor. Yet, unlike the emperor's long extravaganzas of drinking, the celebrations Esther and Mordechai describe are fixed in scope. They set a specific time for a persecuted people to release their stresses, not a license to engage in over-the-top parties and weeks of reckless abandon. Yet for many, it did not feel like a time for celebration. So they established that Purim must also involve reaching out to all sectors of the community with gifts of food and donations to the needy. The entire community was saved in those miraculous days. The entire community needed to be included in giving thanks for that miracle. That's an essential lesson of Purim for very difficult times. The Jews are in pain, but they need to also see the positive in the situation, to give thanks for those who are doing good, to recognize the helpers and the first responders and the supporters in Israel and beyond the borders, and the successes, even as they mourn the terrible losses and do all they can to bring home the long-suffering hostages. Purim isn't about the dress-up or the drinking or the joking around. It's an appreciation of the gift that the great power of the day permitted the Jewish people to defend themselves in the face of a genocidal plot. That is surely a message that resonates with the Jewish experience through the centuries. Those who don't feel like gathering with friends and family, for whom October 7th is still too raw for even a modest celebration, can focus instead on the mitzvah of the day that involves helping others. Bring joy to children who are evacuees from frontline communities in Israel's north or south. Visit hospitals or run Purim activities at local retirement homes, or offer to read the Megillah for those who are housebound. And that is how Jews have always handled such things. It isn't about themed baskets or baking marathons. It's about seeing others in your community, a neighbor you aren't even that close to, but who is going through a crisis, and coming together as a community to help one another, even in communities where there has been such tragedy. There is kindness and there is love, and people need to become more transparent. This is an opportunity to let people feel like they've been seen. Mordechai and Esther, and the rabbi whose documents were buried under the milk churns in the Warsaw ghetto, shared the same perspective. In the face of tragedy, take your grief and your trauma and your despair and turn it towards kindness and compassion. And this, of course, at the same time that Christians around the world, where they're allowed to, are celebrating the holiest week of the year. That's right. This is Holy Week, and it began on Palm Sunday, which was, of course, symbolic of Jesus' triumphant entry into Jerusalem on a colt, on a donkey, not what the Jews were expecting. They were waiting for a king on a white stallion to defeat the Romans, and all of their expectations certainly didn't look like the little guy on the donkey coming to Jerusalem. Little did they know that that man was the Son of God. And for Christians, this is an important week. On Monday, Jesus went into the temple and he turned over the tables of the money changers. And I see a very common theme for Christians today. How much of your worship experience, how much of your church life revolves around bright lights and concertina halls where music is played and where very little attention is paid to your community, where people aren't inviting in non-believers, when people aren't extending their hands to the suffering in our community? We've got homeless, we've got the mentally ill, we've got people who are alone, who've been abandoned. Here in Florida, we have senior citizens who have no way of getting out of their homes, have been terrorized by their own government during COVID, and some of them still haven't left their houses. And if they do, they cover themselves with masks, which will provide them with no protection. And yet, where are the rest of the Christian community? Why aren't they reaching out and taking people to the church during this Holy Week? Because that's what it is. And for anybody who calls themselves a Christian to not be extending that kind of incredible community to everyone, well, I don't want to be with you when you stand in front of the judgment. I really don't, because Jesus did certain things leading up to his crucifixion. And I'm not asking Christians to do everything that he did, but certainly, isn't it time to do something? If he could do things leading up to what he knew was his crucifixion, then certainly we can. The triumphal entry was one thing, but the next day he cleansed the temple and he also cursed the fig tree. Came in riding on a donkey. Sometimes I think about how anticlimactic that must have been for the Jews who were expecting this warrior. But Jesus gets to town and they're all shouting Hosanna. They're all calling him the Son of David. Little did he know, or actually he did know. Of course, by the end of the week, they were shouting Crucify him. And those are lessons that need to be remembered. The cursing of the fig tree is connected to the temple cleansing because they were both indictments against the temple system and the corrupt religious leaders. The fig tree was advertising fruitfulness, but was in reality good for nothing. And unfortunately, that's still true of many temples in our communities. The temple system, Jesus was showing, was outwardly beautiful, but inwardly rotten to the core. One of Jesus's final actions was to symbolically turn his back to the religious leaders of the day and the temple system. What should have brought life was crushing people and shutting the doors of the kingdom in the face of others. And then the anointing at Bethany, this isn't technically something that Jesus did, but more what was done to him. In Bethany, a woman who is identified as Mary in John's gospel anointed Jesus with expensive perfume. And this act of extravagant devotion was met with criticism by some disciples. But Jesus defended her, recognizing it as a preparation for his burial. The gospel writers also intentionally have the religious leaders lurking in the background. It's a beautiful contrast. Mary breaks up this jar of expensive perfume. It would have been her most valuable possession, but she has now found one who is more valuable. And she busts up her treasure in order to give it to Jesus. But the religious leaders are the opposite. They were plotting to kill Jesus. Just as that alabaster jar burst upon the floor, so the religious leaders wish they could have done to Jesus. And that is what the idolatrous heart will always do. It will sacrifice Jesus for the idol. The redeemed heart does the opposite. It sacrifices the idol for the sake of Jesus. There is no action on the part of Jesus there. He just was accepting the worship. That's profound. Worship was reserved for God alone. By allowing this expression of worship, Jesus was taking his rightful place as the object of affection. And then there's the Last Supper. It was a Passover meal. When Jesus himself wanted to explain to his disciples what his forthcoming death was all about, he didn't give them a theory. He gave them a meal. Very Jewish. It's amazing to me that in Luke, Jesus says, "I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." Earnestly desired is an expression of intense longing. It's his last night, and he wants to be with his friends. Certainly, we see his humanity here. He loves these men that he has spent these 3 years with, and Passover was a picture, a celebration of God's rescue. Jesus would have sat around this table with the disciples whom he loved dearly. Certainly, the Son who would have been present at the original Passover now sees the fulfillment. It's no longer in shadow form, but now the Lamb of God would spill his blood for humanity, pictured in the very disciples around the table. And that is why he is excited. Yes, it is a time for suffering, but this is the time for the good news. It's because of the joy set before him that he'll endure the brutal cross. I also can't help but think about those men who are around the table. Jesus knows their future. In only a few moments, they'll fall asleep at Jesus' time of greatest need. He knows that Peter is only hours from betraying him, and the other disciples will walk away. He will be abandoned by the very ones that he will share this meal with. He knows all the ups and downs of their muddy obedience. Peter will be a hypocrite, but he'll also have times when he totally gets it. He will see all the failures and falls and boneheaded things they will do until the point of their death, but that isn't his focus on that moment. It's on the meal. The significance of this meal will overcome all their weakness and rebellion. And after the Last Supper, Jesus shares an intimate moment with his disciples. In the Gospel of John, this is known as the Farewell Discourse, and it culminates in Jesus' prayer for them, and ultimately for us. This might be one of the most intimate moments in all of Jesus' ministry. This discourse itself is rich in theology and pastoral care. Most see the discourse as having several distinct parts. The first part focuses upon his departure and their sorrow, and here he gives them assurance of his love and continued dedication to them. He will give them the Comforter. Jesus then moves to the metaphor of abiding in the vine. It's a call to obedience and pointing to Jesus as the source of their continued life. And after this part of the discourse, Jesus circles back to the promise of the Spirit. But now the Spirit will help them with coming persecution. There's a contrast between the world and their love for one another. The farewell discourse closes with Jesus' prayer for the disciples, as well as those of us who would become disciples through their ministry. Jesus intercedes for the disciples and for all future believers like me, asking the Father to protect them from evil, to sanctify them in the truth, and to unify them as one. And in that prayer, we see Jesus' heart for his followers and his hopes for the future. The heart of the Good Shepherd is on full display here. One of the last things Jesus did was to assure the disciples and encourage them. He then prays for them. Even in his final moments, Jesus was thinking of others. And that is the story of Judaism and Christianity. Stop thinking of yourself and start thinking of others. Be kind and compassionate. If you enjoyed this No Restraint podcast, pass it along to a friend, and you'll have a new one coming up soon. May God bless you, may God bless Israel, and may God bless the United States of America.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast has been brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit CodeRedRoofers.com.